Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Lodo. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. Thank you for supporting local bookstores and for supporting our author events. We really appreciate that. Tonight, we're so fortunate to have best-selling award-winning author of the Commissario Guido Brunetti. I knew I'd foul that up. Brunetti. I was only in Italy 12 days, but anyway. Donna Leon, who will talk about her 20th book in the series, Drawing Conclusions. Late one night, Brunetti is called away from dinner to investigate the death of a widow in her modest apartment. Though there are some signs of a struggle, the medical examiner rules that she died of a heart attack. And it seems nothing for him to investigate, but he is suspicious. And he can't shake the feeling that something or someone may have triggered that heart attack. But what? Donna Leon is the winner of CWA McAllen Silver Dagger for Fiction, among many awards. She was born in New Jersey and has lived in Venice for 30 years. We're all jealous. Please welcome Donna Leon.
I called home today. The lilacs are out. It's warm. People are walking around in shirt sleeves. No, day after tomorrow.
Oh, benissimo, grazie. Espresso.
I am experiencing, it happens to me every time I come to this country. I find good food everywhere, but I've become, after 40 years of going to Italy, an insufferable coffee snob. Finding espresso is at times very difficult, because in the morning I drink what in Italy, in northern Italy at least now, is called un macchiatone. Caffè macchiato, there's espresso, un caffè, un espresso, is a little coffee. A macchiato is, macchiare means to make dirty, to dirty something. So you dirty the coffee with a little bit of milk, just a little bit, or a little bit of foam. Then there's cappuccino, which for me has too much milk. So between the two, a macchiatone is a big macchiato. So it's about as much milk as there is coffee and some foam on the top. Only in the Veneto, in northern Italy, do people know about macchiatone. If you go into other parts of Italy, they go, what? My favorite so far is the whole Starbucks low-fat milk phenomenon. Because I explained that I would like... No, at Starbucks, it's a double espresso, wet macchiato. That means you get a double espresso. No, it took me a week in Chicago, Boston, New York to get this down. So I just go into double espresso, wet macchiato, and they know immediately what it is. However, they make the mistake, and this is in a place where to eat anything offered to you is to go immediately into insulin shock. The coffee is okay, but the pastries in Starbucks, in fact, the pastries almost anywhere in this country to me are almost inedible simply because of the sugar. So what I get off sometimes, unless I remember, but it's usually 6:30 in the morning, so I don't remember that I want whole milk. So the same people who are giving you coffee caramel coffee latte, which probably has 19,000 calories in it, put low-fat milk in it. I just... It's very, very perplexing. I just can't figure it out. I cannot imagine drinking coffee with low-fat milk.
But I can with whole milk.
How many of you remember Percy Dove tonsils? Remember Ernie Kovacs and Percy Dove Tonsils, the poet with the glasses, and he'd have the book of poetry, and he'd do.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to read one of my poems.
And then he'd pick up a martini, which is a real martini.
One moment, please. So good.
See, I really am an American. Only an American would remember Percy Dove Tonsils. What I'd like to talk about a bit this evening is this whole business of writing crime fiction. What might work and what might not work, what you can think about doing, and what we writer people think about doing. Before I started writing books, I sometimes taught something that's called creative writing, which is pretty, I think it's pretty much a boondoggle, because I don't think you can teach, I don't think you can teach people to write creatively. I do think you can teach people to think about what they write and write more carefully and write better. I think that can be done, and in conscience I tried to do that. But to teach creative writing, either you're creative or you're not. You're not going to learn it when you're a freshman, sophomore at university. What I invariably told students that they had to do or that they should think about doing was to have what I called A, B, and Z. That is, I told them that they had to have the first chapter. Well, actually, I told them that they had to have A, B, C, D, D, D. I told them that they had to plan everything in the book. They had to plan the first chapter and the second chapter and the third chapter and the fourth chapter. They had to know what the relationships among and between all of the characters in the book are or would change to. They had to know who was married to or divorced from whom. That they really had to have a grasp of everything that was going to happen in the book. Mind you, I said this probably before I ever wrote a book, because I never really had an idea of writing a book. Subsequent to that, I have realized that there is a great deal of wisdom or good advice in that suggestion that I made to them. For myself, I need either A or B to get to Z. And that is, I need a scene. To begin a book, all I need is a scene, an opening scene, which is usually the discovery of someone who's been killed. And the mystery then starts to be, why is this person dead? Who has killed this person? The B, for me, is why the person was killed. Because those of you who have read the books know that I'm really not interested in Lord Farnsworthy in the library killed by the Malaysian Chris. I want to know why someone, that is the murderer or murderers, would be moved to commit that action, to take the life of another person. Z is the ending. If I have A or B, I've never had A and B. And I never started a book having both A and B. Usually I have A. Let me give you an example of what A and B are. Those of you who have read some of these books might have read the fourth book, which is called Death and Judgment and called something else in England. It's the one about the traffic in women. It opens with the big truck, the shipment truck up in northern Italy going off a snowy road. And it goes down, it just sort of caroms down a hill and smacks into a tree or into a... I haven't looked at it for 15 years, so I don't remember what it smacks into, but I know it smacks into something. And the back doors of the truck burst open and out fly what the narrator describes as mannequins. They're clothed women who fall in the snow. But then the narrator remarks that the mannequins are bleeding. Subsequently, Brunetti discovers that this was a shipment of women who were being brought into Italy to be prostitutes, without their knowledge and against their will. When I wrote the book, I also had, I didn't have A. What I had was B. And the B was an article that I had read some years before that, both in Corriere and La Repubblica, which spoke of what was going on then in Bosnia, where the war was still going on. So this is an indication of how long ago this happened. This is, what, 15, 20 years ago. In the article, it was reported that snuff films were being made, films in which there is a kind of orgy scene, after which the woman, who probably has been hired to be the protagonist in the orgy scene, is really killed, is really murdered on film. The article that I read said that they were being made in Bosnia, that they were being shipped to Italy where they were reproduced, and they were being shipped all over the world, including America, to be distributed and sold. That's all I had. So when I began the book, or when I started to think about a way to begin the book, I had the motive, which for me is really the most important thing. I knew that the reason for whatever would happen in that completely unwritten book, in that unplanned, unformulated book, would be those snuff films. Then when I turned on the computer, and I start cold, I don't take notes, I just turn it on and go. The idea, I don't like to use the word vision because it brings in all that me stuff. I had an image in my head of this truck coming down the road and breaking open and scattering women all over the landscape. And I used it because the first chapter's obligation, its duty, is not to set up the themes, is not to set up the prevailing metaphors, the leitmotifs that are going to run through. The obligation of the first chapter is to get the reader to read the second chapter. No, it's to get the reader to want, or if you're really lucky, to have to read the second chapter. And I think that those first couple of chapters of a crime book particularly are really vital to the book because their obligation is to hook them. Those chapters have to go. Whoa. And you have to sort of take prisoner your reader because the reader has to be compelled to want to know what is going to happen. Sooner or later, the reader, as the writer, is going to become curious about why all of this stuff happened. And that, to me, is the interesting question. And it's an obvious question. The answer is the interesting part. The Z is the ending. You have to, sooner or later, the book has to stop. And usually crime books stop when what has happened in one and been explained in A and has been explained in B somehow comes together so that the person who did the one for the reason in the B goes to the slammer in the Z. But since I don't think that happens very much, I refer to those of you who have read some of these books, you know that at the end of these books, it's very seldom that the bad guy ends up in the slammer. Very often they end up in holding high political office, or they go untouched, because I am merely reflecting what I observe not only in Italy, but in other countries where powerful people, political people, but mainly powerful people and rich people, they don't go to jail. I don't know how many of you read the article in the last Sunday Times by that guy who was in jail in Louisiana. There was a man who was jailed in Louisiana for a murder which he didn't commit, and a murder, there was a murder committed, I forget the details of it. Blood from the murderer was found on the trousers of the victim. The police took a sample of the blood and registered in the log of the forensic lab the kind of blood of the murderer that was on the trousers of the victim. They arrested some guy. The prosecution had the obligation of giving all of the evidence to the defense. The defense was not given that piece of information, which exonerated the accused. This guy spent 14 years on death row. About a week before he was to be executed, the defense, I believe they were working pro bono, hired an investigator to re-examine with new eyes all of the evidence, and this guy found the microfiche because the actual swab of the blood has somehow disappeared from the records. But there was a microfiche which had to catalog everything that was in the evidence kit. The catalog specified that the blood type was the type of blood not of the accused and convicted and condemned and a week from execution murderer. He was given a retrial, and within 35 minutes the jury set him free. This guy sued the state of Louisiana for $14 million. He was in the slammer for 14 years. He also wanted the prosecutor who deliberately made disappear, I don't want to say destroyed, but made disappear and obscured the evidence of his innocence, to make them responsible in some way. This case percolated its way up to the Supreme Court. And about 10 days ago, they denied his request, as is given the division in the Supreme Court today is pretty much predictable. It was the usual 4-5. And so this guy is out. He's out of jail. He spent 14 years on death row. I think 12 of them in, or 11 of them in solitary confinement. His son, when he was about to be executed, he begged the authorities not to let his son know that he was about to be executed. But the news got out, and his then teenage son found out that his father was going to be executed in a couple of days. And then he learned of that. But now he's out. But he doesn't get any money. And he wrote in his piece he doesn't care about the money. But he wants these people to be held responsible for what would have been a legalized murder. And so in circumstances in which something like this can happen, not in Italy, where many people make jokes about the legal system, where that can happen in a country which is proud of its legal system, and perhaps justly so in some places, I think it is believable that the books end with this kind of ambiguous, unsatisfied ending. Well, an end does end with an ending, doesn't it, Donna? The other thing to which I am much prone as a solution for the books is something I'm really not very comfortable about, and that is my predilection for vigilante justice. I've used it in two books where people who do really bad, bad, bad things are killed by the victims, or by people who take the stand of the victims and kill them. And I find that the analogy I've given previously is that it's like eating a hot fudge sundae. It tastes so good, but you know it's not good for you. And I do feel that way about vigilante justice. I confess that I ate two of them, and that I used it twice in books, but I also confess that I'm really not very comfortable with it, because I do not think that vigilante justice is a solution to anything, just as I don't think that capital punishment is a solution to much. But I used it. Going back to what I said at the beginning about the advice to a student or a novice writer, I think it is good advice. I think it helps a lot if you know where you're going. It'll save you a lot of time, an awful lot of time, if you have some vague idea where you're going. Also, in crime novels, this is much easier, because a novel by someone like Margaret Atwood or Jane Smiley or T.C. Boyle starts here, and it can go anywhere. It can go backwards, it can go there, it can go there, it can go there, because these are real writers. The writer of a crime book has a straight line, because implicit in the form is the obligation to have a crime, is the obligation to have a motive, And is the obligation to reveal to the reader who and why. Obviously, there are exceptions to all of this, but I'm speaking in general. And that, I think, is much easier for a writer, because you've got some sort of, you perhaps don't have a roadmap, but at least you have a straight line in front of you. You know what you have to do. And I think that's the main reason why I'm a little bit skeptical about the tendency of many writers and critics to treat crime fiction on a level with other fiction, for example, the fiction of Margaret Atwood or Cormac McCarthy. I just don't think you can. I really don't think you can put them in the same category. I think that some crime writers are very fine writers, and I think they tell very fine tales. But the other example that I like to give is that if you start with someone who's been battered to death with a baseball bat, it's pretty easy to get your reader's attention. That's going to grab someone's attention. Think of Jane Austen's novels. I think of Jane Austen as one of the great, if not the greatest, English novelist. No one in Jane Austen's novels ever raises their voice, except maybe, what's his name, Lord Bertram, when he comes back in Mansfield Park and he finds this play going on. He's really upset about this. But other than that, in Jane Austen, there's very, very little raised noise from the human voice. And yet her novels, I'm sure, are going to long live most, if not all, crime fiction. People will be reading Jane Austen for as long as we're around. I shouldn't, in a sense, dirty my own cage, but I come from an academic background. I've spent my life since I was about 15 reading and talking about and thinking about and writing about literature and teaching literature. And so I do tend to make that distinction between us and them. And I have much greater regard for what they do than for what we do. Because I think most great novels you'll read and read and read again. The joy of reading Jane Austen is in rereading Jane Austen, and the joy in Dickens is in rereading Dickens, as with Thackeray, as with Fielding. The books are better the third or the fourth time.
As with Henry James.
Yes. All right, I want to talk also about how I get ideas. I'm drinking lots of coffee. Since I live in a city which is very small, Venice has 50,000 people. 50,000. That's teeny weeny. That's what, a neighborhood here? It's a small group of people. Most of these people, if they do not know people in the city, know someone who, with two steps, can get to almost anyone in the city. I once asked a friend of mine how long his family had been Venetian, and he said since the 13th century. He's been to school with many of the politicians. He's been to school with many of the people who own businesses and who own restaurants and hotels in the city. He went to school, or his kids went to school, with other Venetians, because only Venetians go to school in Venice. He has proven to me an invaluable source, because if I want to know about something, I ask him. I call Lino and I say, Lino, do you know this? Do you know this guy? Or if I hear a rumor, I will call him and ask for perhaps a variant version of the rumor, because the standard rumors in Venice have lots of variants. One of the classic rumors, those of you who have spent any time in Venice have probably heard it, is the one about the drawings, either Tiepolo or Titian drawings. That's originally, there you have two variants. Sometime soon after the end of the war or during the war, a man who is now a dealer in art, bought from a man or a woman who was or who was not Jewish, this portfolio of 43 drawings. There's no variant. It's always 43. Either by Tiepolo or Tiziano. And they are in a bank vault. What is a constant is that the person who sold them had to sell them to get some money, probably to get out of Italy if possible. This story I have heard, I think, six times in my time in Venice. And each time I'm told it, I always pretend complete ignorance, that I've never heard this story, because I want to hear the variations. Very often people will gossip. Well, we all gossip. We all do it. We all love it. And so very often people will say things to me. In this book, Drawing Conclusions, there is a story told about a will. The story about the will was told to me by this same friend whose family has been in Venice since the 13th century. 15 years ago, we were at dinner, and he said something about a case that he knew where this happened, about a will. This happened. And that's what I use in the book. He also is the source of the story in, I think it's in the previous book or the one before that, about the person who needs to slow down a judicial process so that it will run out, the statute of limitations will pertain, and the case will be dismissed because it hasn't been settled within the standard, the requisite period of time. He was doing this. He told me what he was doing in order to corrupt the legal system. And 10 years later, when I needed a way to connect two people in a book, I said, oh, yes, why don't I do that? Because it would slow down. And so I use that as an idea for a book. All right, thank you very much for coming, blah, blah, blah. And I'll gladly sign books.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.